good morning. Thank you all so much for coming out to our seminar this morning, early morning. It's seminar H, Getting What You Want or Really What You Need, Advocacy for Financial Resources. My name is Erin Rhodes, and I am the Archives Education Librarian at Colby College Special Collections and Archives in Waterloo, Maine. And I'm really excited and pleased to be the moderator for this session. First off, I would like to thank Trulet Books for supporting and sponsoring this session. Every seminar had a sponsor this conference, so we're very grateful for their support. So before I introduce our amazing panel of speakers, I wanted to say that we envisioned the structure of the seminar as follows. After introductions, each speaker will speak for about 7 minutes and share their advocacy story. And then we'll move into sort of a Q&A session. We had thought about breaking out into smaller breakout groups to discuss some questions that we had prepared. But with the room set up and for a desire for the session to sort of flow more organically, and because it's early and nobody wants to have a breakout session at 8:30 in the morning, for your sake, we decided what we'd do is put our questions up on screen and invite the audience to into a sort of a group discussion, let that sort of wander where it may. We know that many of you may have advocacy stories of your own to share, so we wanted to create a space where those can be told as well. And we do have, the questions will be on the screen, but we also have printouts of them that we can pass out as well. Also, just a reminder that the seminar is being recorded. When we thought about doing the breakouts, we thought we'd block the mics out so the session, that part would not be recorded, so I'm not sure how that's going to work. You know, if there's anything confidential or discreet and anything that, you know, happens in seminar H would stay in seminar H, but we'll see how that will work. Maybe we won't be able to be as forthright as we might have been. So also by way of introducing the seminar, many of you may have attended the wonderful seminar at last year's conference, Common Sense, Charm, and a Glass of Wine, Successfully Navigating Donor Relations in Special Collections, which was a really great conversation on the external facing work of donor relations. This seminar, I think, will be a wonderful complement to that session as it focuses more on inward facing internal advocacy for resources, and this is often more than just financial resources within our organizations. This advocacy work is about storytelling, it's about your story, it's about successes and failures, about learning how to do a part of your job that you are not often formally taught or given the tools or language to accomplish. It's about relationship building, perspective gained, looking inward to allies in your organization and internally to what you and your program can realistically do and what it is that you need to do your work. And during the plenary session yesterday, someone mentioned that they were really struggling with the story they wanted to tell to the people who hold the purse strings in the organization, and that it was difficult and challenging for them to find the language and find the story to tell. Why does it take so many resources to do what we do? How do we learn to ask, and how do we learn to tell? How do we advocate for the non-material, less glamorous things that we really need? So that said, I would like to introduce each of our speakers by way of reading their carefully crafted bios. So please bear with me for a few moments because the bios are written to sort of match what they will be talking about today. So I'm going to go in order of the speakers. So in March of 2016, Maddie Teomina became the director of the Sutro Library, a branch of the California State Library. After working for a decade as head of public services for Stanford University Special Collections, Maddie now finds herself in a resource-challenged state agency where basic library needs often go unmet. This is her first directorship position, and every day is a lesson in advocacy. She has successfully advocated for a new full-time librarian position and is beyond thrilled to have finally secured much-desired foam cradles and paging slips for her collection. Yes. Maddie is literally fighting for her library to continue to exist, so her remarks will encompass advocacy sort of writ large, writ globally, a quest not just for financial resources, but for all resources, the critical role that advocacy plays, and for justifying why her doors should stay open. Being subject to the whims of the state of California budget also creates additional obstacles for her that others may not have to deal with. Next, Rebecca Irwin been curator and director of special collections and archives at Middlebury College in Vermont since 2014. Prior to her current role, she served as head of collections, technical services, and digital scholarship also at Middlebury. Before Middlebury, Rebecca embraced and cast off long job titles at the Beinecke Rare Books and Manuscript Library at Yale University for just under a decade. While at the Beinecke, two of Rebecca's longer lasting titles included the head of digital projects and metadata and interim head of technical services. In her current role, Rebecca oversees Middlebury's rare books and manuscript collection, the college archives, the conservation, preservation, and digitization of library collections, and she is at the helm of the Friends of the Library fundraising organization. And though she won't likely see the bulk of the fruits of her labor during her professional lifetime, Rebecca has raised over $650,000 in expendable and endowed funds since 2014. And, spoiler alert, she has also lost financial resources, but I'll leave that to Rebecca to disclose. And Audra Eagle-Young is head of special collections and archives at the University of California, Irvine. Her first foray into advocacy for financial resources began as a local history librarian in a public library, where she wrote a proposal to the Friends of the Library to purchase 5 Hollinger boxes. As an archivist at a private university and a large public research university, she pursued internal and external funding for archival supplies, temporary staff, and technology. Audra has led a team of 9 since 2014, successfully procuring over $300,000 in university funding for special projects. She also advocated for a $250,000 building and a variety of technology and building enhancements. Audra received an MLIS with a specialization in archival studies from UCLA and a BA in literature and cultural theory from Duke University. And finally, Alice Schreier began her career as a reference librarian in the Rare Book and Manuscript Library at Columbia University and was appointed to her current position, Roger and Julie Bask's Vice President for collections and library services at the Newberry Library in August 2015. In between, she was director of special collections at the University of Delaware, director of the Special Collections Research Center at the University of Chicago, associate university librarian for area studies and special collections, and interim director at Chicago. As a result of these increasingly administrative positions, she has a perspective on the importance of perspective that she looks forward to sharing. So now I'll turn it over to our speaker.
Thank you everyone for being here so early in the morning, and I want to thank my esteemed panelists. It's such an honor to be on this panel with you guys. I've definitely, for the last 10 years, watched you all go through your transitions of jobs and have always been in awe and very inspired. And so I'm really proud to be joining the ranks of directorship and having all female directors on the panel. So our presentations this morning build on one another in order of experience and fiscal success. And since I'm the most junior in both regards, I get to start us off. Who here, just out of curiosity, has heard of the Sutro Library? That's awesome. So advocacy is often about telling stories, and what I'd like to do is discuss what happens when you want to change that story. What happens if you are not overly happy with the story that's been told and you need a new narrative? My advocacy experience thus far has focused on doing just that for the Sutro Library. So I'd like to tell you a story about a rare book and manuscript library. And like most library stories, ours begins with a man. Once upon a time, in the late 1880s, actually to be more specific, a Prussian immigrant named Adolf Sutro was living in San Francisco. One time mayor of that fine city, he was known throughout the land as an entrepreneur, inventor, real estate mogul, philanthropist, and unabashed bibliophile. Motivated by populist ideals and a deep sense of civic purpose, he determined to create and endow a great public research library for his adopted city. Soon he created the largest private library in America. It held over 300,000 titles. It was unrivaled for both its size and the richness of its holdings, to include 3,000 incunabula. At that Brown University professor George Lincoln Burr wrote at the time, "It is, I think, beyond all comparison, the best collection in America, both as to numbers and as to quality of the books of the 15th century. And I gravely doubt it has any rival this side of the Atlantic for its literature of the 16th century." I imagine at this point in our history, you're wondering, how is it I've barely heard about this library? And you guys have actually heard about it, so it's impressive. The answer to that question, though, follows a series of unfortunate events that plunged this library into obscurity, a deep sleep, as it were. When our hero dies in 1898, he leaves no updated will. He leaves no updated will, no library building, and no endowment. As the heirs become embroiled in litigation, the 1906 earthquake and fire consumed over half of this collection. Giving the Sutro Library the distinction of being the only library to survive that devastating tragedy. The collection was given to the state of California with the proviso that the library be open to the public and it must never leave San Francisco city limits. In 1917, the library opened in the cramped basement of Stanford University's Lane Medical Library. After a decade, it moved again into an equally inadequate space at the San Francisco Public Library, where the conditions, neglect, lack of adequate staff, and security did much to damage what was left of the historic collection. But more damaging to the Sutro was the systemic lack of support from its custodian, the state of California. For nearly half a century, the California legislature repeatedly failed to provide funding for the collection maintenance or the construction of a building to house this magnificent collection. During these years, the library regularly faced total elimination, with proposals to either return the collection to the Sutro heirs or give the collection to the University of California. Considerable negative publicity over the beleaguered and endangered collection was made worse when two Sutro heirs sued the state to block yet another move of the Vagabond Library. By the time the Sutro Library moved into another temporary building on the edge of San Francisco State University's campus in the early 1980s, the decades of bad publicity and lack of institutional support had taken its toll. Desperate to change the story again and gain some champions, the state librarian revamped the Sutro. At that time, it was the state librarian, Gary Strong, if anyone knows him. He was committed to somehow saving the Sutro after all of this bad press, and so he revamped the library into a genealogical library, plunging the rare antiquarian collection into further darkness. So this has been our story for 100 years, and it's continued to be our story despite the fact that in 2012, the Sutro moved into its first permanent home, a shiny new joint-use building shared with San Francisco State University's Academic Library. We are ideally positioned in the heart of campus with 30,000 undergraduates outside our door. They are not doing genealogy. As much as I esteem Gary Strong, I think Dr. Kevin Starr had the better vision when he lobbied and advocated for us to get this beautiful building. We owe this to him and his efforts, and genealogy is not in the cards. So while we inherited the best version of the Sutro Library to date, we also inherited some significant challenges. We are on a college campus and act as an extension of the Academic Library, but we are a state agency. And as a state agency, we lack the basic architecture that comes with universities. We have no ardent supporters of the antiquarian collection. We have no development officer. We have no alumni, no faculty. We have very few established external relationships. Our decision makers who hold our funding are 2 hours away. What I've learned about advocacy so far is that you have to tell a more compelling story than the one that's currently known. For me, advocacy began the day I interviewed for this job, and I advocated that the Sutro return to Adolph Sutro's original mission. I described a different version of what the Sutro could be, and luckily the current state librarian agreed. Now I'm charged with bringing that version to life, and I can attest that even if you're small and scrappy like us, effective advocacy can actually still happen. We are reimagining this historic library. We are staff then used that information to create the first ever strategic plan for the Sutro Library, which will help us build external and internal relationships. This document articulates our goals, helps crystallize what we really need to ask for, and helps our administration and donors know where we're headed and how they can help us get there. With our plan in place, we advocated for dramatic changes to our institutional processes. Being a state agency, we've always done it that way, is a life motto. It's not just a work thing, it's a life motto. So advocacy in this area actually is the most critical to us at this time. And it can be hard to lobby for change when you're 2 hours away from the hallways where all these decisions seem to occur, because they always occur in a hallway. So I've had to become a little bit more creative on how I can influence the remote decision makers. I made a video for my boss, for example, detailing why we wanted to change how single manuscript items were cataloged. I described the problem, detailed the fiscal savings the change would realize, and proposed a new workflow. It took 4 months of me asking her every week in our one-on-ones, but the change was approved last week. Lastly, advocacy requires trust. I'm so blessed that I have finally found my administrative ally and my boss. I have an outstanding boss who is an archivist. Do not underestimate the power of having somebody at the top that is a special collections archivist person. It makes all the difference. An amazing change for me. So I have an amazing boss, and she is my administrative ally. My stakeholders trust in my ability to change the Sutro's narrative, and that my team can achieve the goals that we laid out in our strategic plan. The Sutro of today and tomorrow would not be possible without a deepening commitment from the State Library to share in this vision of the new Sutro. The challenge for us now is to become our own hero, which will require a relentless amount of advocacy and outreach. But it is time for the Sutro Library. We are writing our happily ever after. We are asleep no more. Especially when it comes to preserving the more digital, like email websites and social media. I have a hunch that we talk differently to our library and institutional administrators when advocating for funds in support of our traditional collections, our material collections, than the language we use in support of what, for the purposes of today, I'll lazily call next generation collections, and that encompasses the more digital, social media, and others. So that is, the tropes of specialness have so far, for me, and I think perhaps some of you, have been great motivators for administrators and donors to support our work. But I often wonder if radical growth and stewardship of our next generation collections is hindered if we rely too heavily on nostalgia. Advocating for the acquisition, preservation, and hands-on use of material archives and manuscripts
literal effort, and it tugs directly on the heartstrings of their own nostalgia for what a library is about, what deep and patient reading is or was for them when they were at Middlebury College or at any school, and the value we place on physical art, the value we place on physical artifacts that tell the stories of a collective past. So the image I have represents what is known and understood about our work and our collections. We preserve college history through our archives of publications. And this is actually a promotional photograph that our PR, our Middlebury College, wanted to come to the archives. What they wanted to see was students working with yearbooks, or for them, that's the metaphor, is that they think of the work that we do. We preserve manuscripts and spend time, that's me in the corner, freezing as always in our reading rooms, deciphering, of course, manuscripts from the 19th century with a student group, largely mediated through the human interactions and instruction sessions. For my donor base and my administrators, the staff expertise, technical infrastructure, and access scenarios needed to support next generation collections is somewhat less fathomable. My own peers, my administrators and donors, I'll admit, have on occasion raised their eyebrows with skepticism when I've described our born digital collection practices. Some consider it incongruous, sometimes laughable, that unfiltered blog content, Tumblr tweets, and Facebook posts intermingle with traditional manuscripts and archives, and that is the manuscripts and archives that they hold so dear. We all carry subtle and not so subtle biases, a print run of the Dial versus an Instagram account, a handwritten diary, always in impenetrable cursive, versus screenshots of inflammatory naked posts. But yet, my donor network and many of my college administrators are accomplished and thoughtful professionals, obvious and active citizens of the 21st century. And even they still let slip unfiltered skepticism at the logic and sustainability of the tools and techniques we're using right now to capture contemporary social and literary histories, mainly through online social media and more digital. It feels different to them, and so I find myself advocating for material collections one way and next generation collections another way. At Middlebury, that looks like this. There was a tidal wave of social media posts and Facebook Live videos that documented student protests when Charles Murray, the author of The Bell Curve, was invited to campus this past March, and our students shut down the lecture. And this, a Tumblr documenting LGBTQI community members and their pronoun prefaces. This is an ongoing collection. And both of these, you'll notice, we collect through our content, but I know the software platform it's coming from. And this, an Instagram account called Proctor Bowls, featuring much loved and much purloined dining hall bowls frolicking around the world. Years, the college was replacing, at the cost of tens of thousands of dollars, $30,000 in its height, in dish replacement costs. The whole campaign started to try to lure students to bring back dishes. This past year, actually this summer, these dishes, beloved Proctor Bowls and others, were being decommissioned, setting in motion an archives dumpster dive to save a set for succeeding historians of college life. So, you have found me dumpster diving behind the Proctor Bowl. There's so few questions. What does a language of advocacy look like that dissolves the divisions across our collections? When manuscripts, incunables, Tumblr literary journals, and Facebook feeds are inseparable when we make our pitches to administrators and to donors. Are we at a point in time, and is it safe for us, to imbue the same sense of sacred, the treasure tropes, in next generation collections as we so often have done with those collections freighted with the historical burden of materiality? Assuming we have all code switched at one time or another, that is, found ourselves sussing out an administrator or a donor to try to figure out if they're a techie or a bookish person, in order to find the right language to turn them on to our most pressing needs, can you imagine and start to use a language of advocacy that doesn't require disparate talking points?
lure them in with nostalgia, but then capture their imagination with the challenges and anticipation of next generation collections. Is it fathomable that the same donor who wants to see their name on a book plate 1 year might support an archiving account or a digital preservation tool the next? So I'll end there with questions rather than answers, fruit for our question and answers, I hope. And if someone pulls my arm during the question and answer, I will share this tragic and relevant story about lost funds, but I decided to end on more positive.
Cheerleading vein, like you said, so I'm gonna switch gears. My first librarian position taught me the value of a single archival box. Until that time, I had always done project-based work, an allocation of folders, boxes, student assistants, volunteers, etc., which was provided to me until resources or time ran out. Working in the local history department of an urban public library was my dream. I asked my supervisor, could we build a cage for our rare books? Get foam cradles? Could we buy some archival boxes? His response, an amused chuckle. With what budget? A few years later, at a large public university, I found myself standing alone in my boss's office, suddenly my office. Our supply budget was a few $100s, our collections budget was zero. I want to talk today about the centrality of storytelling and advocacy for financial resources from the perspective of a mid-level manager who's still figuring things out. But first, look at this house. Not bad, right? Did you notice that it needs shutters, a new coat of paint, better curb appeal? Or did you notice the welcoming porch, the happy color, the quality of its materials? Both these perspectives are accurate and valid, but only one has more potential to appeal to a buyer. Asset-based community development originated in 1993's Building Communities from the Inside Out.
I think they lost power.
They lost power.
Where's that lady? I don't know if we can charge it.
Oh, the battery.
Maybe, yeah.
So I know this session is being recorded and I want everyone to be able to hear. I think most people can hear me, but I would really like to see if this can work.
Yeah.
It's turning back on.
But it may not have power.
Oh, yes. It's flashing.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us the secrets now?
Yeah, the secrets.
Yeah, I'll tell my story if you want.
Fundraising after dark.
I don't know if it's like a
fundraising in the dark.
And the recorder has nothing to do with the microphone.
Okay.
Okay.
I might have some.
I have some double A's.
So okay.
Just trying to figure out how to open it.
Okay.
Try.
I can try to read loudly.
Stand up.
Yeah, good idea. I'll project. Okay. So asset-based community development was originated in 1993's Building Communities from the Inside Out by John Kretzmann and John McKnight. Kretzmann and McKnight's work based in social work for rebuilding communities and neighborhoods that have been marginalized as needy, problematic, and deficient. Traditional approaches for community improvement have been deficiency-oriented. That is, teaching people that listing out their needs and asking for resources as the best ways to fix their problems. In fact, these needs-based assessments teach us to highlight our problems and ignore our already existing strengths and capacities. In illustrating a formula for successful community building, the authors emphasize the importance of being asset-based, internally focused, and relationship-driven. So asset-based. Be realistic. This strategy starts with what is present, the capacities of people you have, and those with whom we collaborate and associate. It's not about what's absent and what is problematic and what is needed. Planning must be concentrated and self-focused, starting with the team as you define it. Figure out who's on your team. In doing this, you stress what you can control and can focus on creativity and hope. And when you work within your team, and know the assets you're working with, you can pursue relationships with other teams, agencies, individual donors, etc. It was very difficult for me to reframe my thinking to center on the positive, considering that for several years our department had a budget of zero and no promise for recruitments. But I worked with my team to develop priorities and language language to articulate our goals without focusing on what we lacked. Some considerations for the application of asset-based advocacy. Instead of focusing on needs, deficiencies, lack, or weakness, talk about effectiveness, gifts, strengths, talents, and expertise. Instead of spiraling into hopelessness and despair with no staff, no money, we've all been there, continually try to put yourself into a place of gratitude, thinking about realism, thankfulness for the experts in-house, the collections we're building, what we can accomplish with what we have right now. Instead of thinking about those we feel are consumers, gatekeepers, or critics, consider people who are producers, facilitators, and partners. Instead of what they won't do upstairs, over there, think about what we can do right here and now. Finding affinities or areas of similarity or difference that unite us in doing more together than we could do on our own helps to build that morale of whatever your team is, whatever you're calling your team. Ask yourself, what are we really good at? What are we known for? Within our department, within the US, in the world, what do we have? It's a continuous practice. At UCI, our famous Southeast Asian archive was kept in a cramped corner of our library, barely any room for collection storage, let alone instruction and events. I work closely with our archivist and other staff to articulate our success in engaging with the Southeast Asian American community. How our work and collections were highlighted in the newspaper, and the dramatic increase in instruction requests. How could we continue to do this in our space? Bid on a winner. People want to give their resources to someone or something with proven success. Instead of saying we need a new space, which was really true, we did, I said we're so successful. How can we keep up with this growth? We were able to get administration and campus support for a larger space. What's there to gain? You're trying to convince people to invest, to make an investment in something they believe will have an impact and will become successful. For the Southeast Asian Archive, we continually talk to stakeholders about our vision for growth, the connection to the campus strategic plan, and our commitment to community engagement. Share your success. To get what you want, your proposal must be designed to give the funder what they want too. What can we build together if you join us in investing in this project? Let's be partners in making something exciting and worthwhile happen. Make it real. Paint a picture, the possible future of lasting value of what you're doing. And deliver, track what you're doing, and use your success to tell new stories for further investment. Part of our annual planning in my department includes mapping out programming and marketing for the services of the Southeast Asian Archive, especially reaching the stakeholders who supported us from the beginning. So let's return to our house. Know your audience. Know what matters to them. My administration likes a menu of options and scenarios. Everything must align with our strategic plan. That's what works where I'm at. Do what's expected with the support you receive and then ask for more. Show them that you're trustworthy to do more than what originally was built out. You will fail. Why not ask? Why not try to tell your story again and in different ways? No one knows the strengths and potential of your labor, your team's labor, your collections, and no one knows your people better than you. I've made a lot of mistakes. I'm still learning to adjust my advocacy to be a matchmaker for what I'm trying to do and the interests and values of our allies. Build your house, even if it's brick by brick. And special thanks to Michelle Light, Linda Claussen, and my co-panelists. I'm honored to be here with you. And I wanted to publicly thank my partner Andy for caring for our children so that I can be here. And thank you to the seminars committee for to each of you for being here. Looking forward to our discussion. Thank you. To this point in the program, and nobody pointed out the irony of this session meeting in a bank. So, with thanks, right? Take it from there. So, as you heard from Aaron, over the course of my career, I've advocated for financial resources from a variety of positions within special collections and research libraries.
The most important lesson I've learned is that you and your boss see things very differently. In fact, they usually see different things. The more you understand your boss's perspective, the better you will be at helping him or her see your cause as a good investment and want to support it. As you know, I began my career as a reference librarian in the Rare Book and Manuscript Library at Columbia University. I was determined to provide the best possible service to researchers and had a strong sense of what at least I thought that required. A faculty member wanted photocopies that afternoon, no cameras in the reading room then. Of course, we needed enough student workers to fill such orders. A visiting scholar was giving a talk based on one of our collections whom I had helped. Why didn't we have enough staff to relieve me from my morning desk shift? I thought mostly about what I needed from my boss, training, priorities, and resources. Looking back, I find it embarrassing to admit how little I thought about what bosses need from us to get their jobs done, let alone what pressures they face. The word advocacy was just not in my work or working vocabulary. IBMS played a huge role in broadening my perspective through opportunities to meet special collections librarians from other institutions at a different stages in their careers. My most important mentors have been colleagues, many of whom I'm happy to say are now dear friends, who I met and worked with on RBMS committees. And being active in RBMS, especially in areas where you need support from ACRL or ALA, is a great way to hone advocacy skills. Prepared in large part by this professional growth, I began my first managerial position as head of special collections at the University of Delaware. From that vantage point, it became clear that all the units within Special Collections are interdependent. I looked behind the scenes, not just in front of me at the reading room. The hardest part of being a manager is saying no to resource requests. It's fun to say yes, and you make people happy. And I also learned that Special Collections needs to position itself as an integral part of the entire library. So looking beyond the reading room and looking beyond the confines of Special Collections, these insights were essential to building effective advocacy strategies. Advocacy is closely related to, but distinct from, fundraising. Advocacy aims to influence decision makers through education and communication. As we have heard from others on this panel, we're mostly advocating for what funding makes possible, not a certain amount of money in the bank, which is what fundraising usually is. So, for example, I was the only librarian in Special Collections when I arrived at the University of Delaware. Additional staffing was my highest priority, and when I left 6 years later, the department had 4 librarians. I can't take all the credit for this at all, because the timing was right to work toward expansion of Special Collections. We had a new facility and an ambitious director who wanted to raise his ability and was an early adopter, or at least amenable, to the now cliched view of Special Collections as the distinguishing feature of a research library. The point is always talk about impact. You're asking for additional resources for a program, service, or operation that will help the library achieve its desired outcome. And sometimes what we need doesn't even cost anything. For example, real estate on the library's homepage, representation on library or university-wide committees to have a voice at a table. These issues are often political, but the advocacy skills are transferable. While I was at the University of Chicago, I moved from middle management to senior library leadership with a mercifully brief stint as library director. I had to rethink my approach to advocacy at every step along the way. Early on, as
as part of the Harvard Leadership Development Program, I read a Harvard Business Review article called Managing Your Boss. It was published in 1955, that Mad Men era, and now a classic. It taught me to see my boss as a human being, imagine that, with strengths and weaknesses, and a preferred work style. Did she like longer, short emails? Format, formal memos and agendas in advance of meetings, standing or ad hoc meetings, details or bottom line. Pay attention to clues and adjust your advocacy strategy accordingly. I also began to learn everything I could about the larger environment. What is the current financial situation of the institution? Is it focusing on a new area of research, establishing new centers in some phase of the capital campaign? We can probably all say yes to that one. We need always to think about connecting special collections with advancing institutional priorities. Never assume your boss understands what you do, why it is important, and what you need to succeed. If you report, as Maddie now happily does, to someone who has experience with special collections, you're in great shape. If not, begin with the basics. Invite her or him to tour special collections, but stage it. By all means, show off the gems, especially the ones hiding in the backlog. And make sure that every one of your staff members is prepared to say a few words about their work along your route that also opens the door to you to talk about their need. Funds for archival processing may be the most challenging asks I make. Few outside our community understand the labor-intensive and complex nature of this work. Recently, I proposed a project to a private donor to process a collection and spent a lot of time explaining why this step was a necessary precursor to digitization, which was his real interest. The donor was astonished, dare I say appalled, by the total budget, especially the fact that archival supplies cost more than twice the projected salary for processing assistants. We were going to use interns. Notable failure. Don't assume your colleagues know what you do either. Outreach begins with them. Find ways to collaborate with general reference, instruction, outreach, and subject librarians. They can be powerful partners in advocacy. When the Mansueto Library was being planned, it became apparent that the design would eliminate half of the Special Collections Exhibition Gallery and three offices, the only ones on the first floor. No funding for remediation was included in the construction budget. It just wasn't part of the plan. I was fortunate to have a very supportive library director, and we worked together to convince university administration that it would be a lost opportunity, we use very polite language in public, to leave special collections crippled by these changes. We made presentations on the potential of a new gallery that would create energy and excitement along the main street leading to Mansueto. So if you see that little connector, that's the gallery, that's the corridor to the new library, and that's where special collections and the gallery is actually facing that main street. So everybody goes by the glass enclosed gallery on their way to the egg, as it is now called, the reg and the egg. We talked about how new classroom space, and yes, new offices too, were necessary to maximize the benefits of the increased traffic and new visibility. Thanks to successful advocacy, the Special Collections renovation is a stop on every Mansueto tour, and no one except those of us on the inside of it knew how close this story had come to a very sad ending. When I moved to the Newberry nearly 2 years ago to become Vice President for Collections and Library Services, I had to learn the culture of an entirely new type of library. One closer, in fact, to the Sutro. Although further along on Maddie's vision than Sutro, I guess I can say. The Newberry is an independent research library, free and open to the public, I was familiar with other IRLA independent research libraries like Huntington, Folger, American Antiquarian Society, et cetera, but I never really thought much about what that means in terms of funding. In an academic research library, basic needs, compensation, IT, facilities maintenance are covered by the university, even if not at the levels we would wish for collections and operations. But few independent research libraries have endowments that cover costs. Independent research libraries are governed by boards of trustees to whom the president or CEO reports. Trustees are passionately devoted friends and supporters, very smart people, and usually from the business world. They know that they bear fiduciary responsibility for the institution, which makes economic stability their highest priority, as it should be. It is essential to engage them in strategic planning and create a shared vision for the library, since they will be our chief advocates in securing the funds to implement it. As a privately supported public institution, the Newbery is committed to being a good neighbor and part of the community that surrounds it. This means co-sponsoring activities such as the annual Bughouse Square debates in Washington Square Park, which you see right outside our front door, and planning an entire renovation schedule that will begin on January 1st around the annual book fair, a much beloved community event. The over 200 volunteers who help us run book fair are important advocates and often become donors. They would be crushed and might never return if we skipped even a year. Advocacy, like fundraising, is about developing relationships and building trust, discovering what excites an administrator or a donor, and being able to paint a picture, as Audra also invoked, or tell a story that connects their support to making it a reality.
When I first arrived at Middlebury College, the library and IT were actually merged. It was a single organization, and since I've been there, they were divorced. So now they're actually separate, and resource allocation is a big, it is a problem. One of the challenges that I've been facing over the last 2 years is having IT understand the weight of digital archives, born digital, because one of my responsibilities is also the college archives, that means pressing them to preserve for access institutional email and files, office files, and that is really incomprehensible, particularly to those IT staff that specialize in security. Mm-hmm. So I have had drag out battles with some IT over trying to understand the limits of things like FERPA, in my perspective, and where we should land on issues around student, those what is best thing that I can do is advocate for the complexity of our tools and bring them to the point that they agree they're specialized to a point that it's beyond their expertise and beyond their interest. And so in general, they've supported and helped to fund outsourcing. And some of that comes, it has been Amazon Cloud Services in order to host very large video files, and also a dark archive of born digital files that we host on Amazon, AWS, Amazon Cloud Services, managed by ITS, but they're perfectly happy pitching in some money, but not having it in their hands to think about the preservation and conservation of those records. They are still skeptical, and I have a fairly confrontational relationship with one security, IT security specialist. He doesn't understand and doesn't think it's will ever be possible to share in a research room the email archive of a president of a college, for example. It is beyond it is beyond realism for him. And I don't know that we'll get there, but we keep talking about it. So I think that one solution is turn to our own archival communities in cloud services, so I've turned to Lyrisist to support that software and others, because in some ways some of those, my opinion might be, some of those tools are beyond IT. If their responsibility is everything in the university system, perhaps asking them to host an archive space server might push them over the edge, or you wouldn't get the kind of service you want from them, but you would from Lyrisist or any other hoster. So if you can get there with shared cost savings, for example, in administration, that's what I found to do.
It's interesting because at the Newberry, we do outsource a lot for some of the reasons that Rebecca is discussing. So David, I have a question for you, which is, are you talking about an internal library IT? That complicates it, as you know, because it was surprising to me that that was a possible route at the Newberry, and I assume you were talking about campus IT as well. It's a little more complicated if the IT is in-house because they, as at the University of Chicago, we both know you couldn't really as easily go around. I mean, it's a very elegant solution when it works and one that does at the Newberry too, because the IT department at the Newberry, frankly, is small enough to only be able to deal with things like security and sort of problem solving and bandwidth kinds of key core issues. And so they are more amenable to the outsourcing, but if you're dealing with a large IT where their concerns are interoperability, or you want to do things that have to work and play well with them, I think that you need to find a way to get them interested in what you're doing. I mean, I knew that we would have some success at Chicago when one of our key IT people joined SAA because he was so intellectually interested in some of the finding aid issues that we were trying to work through with him. But just to say that I think the dynamic of the advocacy is different depending on where IT sits or what it is, but it's not an easy issue in either case.
Good luck.
The only thing I would say is it's interesting that, no matter if it's in-house, like you're a small agent, you're a small shop, and you're in a bigger institution, it sounds like you have the same problems. Ours is in-house, but ours is 2 hours away, so there's no IT for us. So when a printer breaks, we have to wait for someone to come from Sacramento. I know that sounds bad, but so what we do basically is we do very similar to what you have. I mean, you have all the resources, but you go around them, and for us, we go around them not because they're not supportive, they're just not there.
Yeah.
And they're very, they're really adamant about trying to help us, but there's limits when they are so far. And we have, a tight budget at the State Library. So instead, I too went through Library Host to source our Archon. We're using Archon to create finding aids. We are trying, again, this is where advocacy becomes a really big deal. We are in a joint use building with San Francisco State University, so we are becoming very shared walls. And so they are amenable to having us use their content DM instance, which will allow us to do a lot more, because they realize now that the Sutro is bringing so much value to their campus that they, I don't think they really realized what was in the Sutro. And when the president just showed up at my door unannounced, wanting some sort of a tour with a donor, I don't know who this person was. I barely knew President Wong. I was like, what are you doing here? No notice. Just came in. And that means that we are on their radar. And I'm going to try to nurture that. So again, another workaround. But I think San Francisco State is our biggest ally. I think they're happy that we're there. And that's my job now, to cultivate as much as I can to make it a win-win. So that's what we're facing. But a workaround, always.
Division. Thank you all so much for sharing your experiences. I did have a question. I was wondering how you work with other development officers and fundraising groups, people, staff, donor relations, the alumni groups in your institution, in your library, that may have competing interests. For example, you're all interested, obviously, in getting funds and material for special collections, but your library may have a donor, you know, relations person who's working for the library in general, and then your institution, of course, will have fundraising people too. How do you work with them? If you do at all, how do you decide on those, you know, competing interests, especially maybe with someone, a very, very big donor who everybody would like to, you know, get to know more?
I think every institution has its own development structure, but I don't know one in which there isn't a fairly well-defined structure for communication among development. So, for example, if there is a very big donor that to the institution writ large, that's going to start at the very top of development. So it won't really be our decision who gets to talk to that donor. It's more likely, the director of the library. If there's a development person in the library, the library development person would sit on a group that includes representatives from development across the institution. Or the president might decide where that, you know, Mansueto at Chicago was funded because the president directed the donor to the library to fill that need that was on the university list. So I guess it's development is usually a pretty top-down, because institutions understandably have to make sure that different units don't approach the same donor and make it look as if within the institution we're not talking to each other or we don't have our priorities straight. So I think that the kind of advocacy you're talking about has to happen between you and your library development officer to prepare her or him when she's at the table with other development officers to explain those needs and hope that they will remember those needs when they're out talking with donors and see a lot of old books around the room and maybe think, oh, this one might be interested in what I heard the library or special collections need. So it's a little more remote than that usually.
For us at the Sutro, which is one of the reasons why I took the job, is it's more flat.
Mm-hmm.
It's very organic. Like I said, the president just came in with this donor. We've had people come to us with offering in-kind gifts. But I guess for us, the conflict is San Francisco State would like those donors. And I'm sitting right here with these amazing
So I'm always aware to make sure whatever's coming my way will directly benefit San Francisco State University, because we're partners now. So there is there was a comment made by a staff member at San Francisco State that in Special Collections, she had said, did you see the president in the magazine when they asked him what's the best thing on San Francisco State campus? I said, no, I didn't see that. She said, he said the Sutro Library, which, remember, we're not part of that. So I really value my colleagues in Special Collections downstairs in State, and I really want to make sure that I'm always aware of how I can add that value and bring them in.
Yeah, so I just wanted to add a little bit to what Alice was saying. At the University of California Irvine, obviously part of a larger structure, there's an advancement, you know, unit, and their strategy is not public, it's very territorial. And so one of the things that I took away, actually Aaron Purcell's book, Donors and Archives, it's mostly about persuading people to give you stuff. But there's a chapter on working with development officers that I felt pretty useful. And they talk about the main objective here is to create your wish list and to create your menu of opportunities, as we call it at UCI, so that you can shop that around. And I'm very willing to tell the whole world what we want and what we want to build, and then give that to all the people and see where it goes. So to your point, yeah. Can I?
Since we're talking about stories, I'll tell one. Early on when I was at Chicago, the then director told me a story about, at that point, and still the main library, so-called, is the Regenstein Library. And he had gone to visit Mrs. Regenstein, and she asked him, well, young man, he was early on in his directorship, what do you need? And he just blanked. You know, he just could not think of anything. And he said, Alice, I never walked out of my office without a wish list in my back pocket. And I sort of mentally took that to heart and always travel with one. So sort of following up what Audra just described so nicely.
Hi, I'm Athena Jackson. I work at Penn State. I have a challenge for you on the spot. So I am a donor that your development officer brought in, white, male, have a lot of money. And your development officer says, I need you to tell them about your vision because I know you're trying to take your vision in a direction for filling historical gaps, surfacing unheard voices, born digital media. He's 70 years old. And yada yada. Can you tell me what you would say in this scenario and how you would? I have my own and I say it, I think, pretty well, but I would love to hear more from people about how we're saying that, because I think that's a reality. I'd love to tell you the scenario of the rich Latino who comes in and says, my son's coming in and I'd love to give, you know, money to you to build a Latin American collection, but that's not quite, we're not there yet in most of the country, but this is a real life scenario for me right now.
Thank you for that question. This is something that I hear about a great deal, and my answer, I don't know how it'll come across, but I still tell that story the same way, no matter who I'm talking to, about what we care about. And what we care about at UCI is underdocumented communities, and we are going to work to do that. So that's what I tell people, even if it means they're not going to match. That's the idea, is that I'm storytelling for what we care about, and what we think is a strategic priority, and if that doesn't match, it doesn't match, and I want to force it.
I appreciate the question too, because I'm actually facing that. But it's not necessarily a donor, it's people in my library. We don't have a collection development plan for the Sutro Library. We still have yet to have one. We're working on it, but we've never had one. So when I advocate that the Sutro needs to have more diversity in our collections that go past 1898, the refrain I have heard from older white males is, we don't see the Sutro that way. So people in our collections, because these people are outside my door. And so that's the story I tell, is that's fine if we don't see the sutro this way, but then that means no one will see the sutro in any way come 50 years. California is one of the most diverse places, and especially the Bay Area. I can't imagine keeping us behind intentionally anymore. And so that's the story I tell, is no one's going to come here if they don't see themselves on my tables. Because let's be honest, if I'm a first-gen student coming in, my background is Asian, why would I care about all of these other things that you have that are all mostly European, or luckily sutro collected all around the world, so I can definitely show them something, but it's going to end in the 1500s. I can make that link, but it's going to get harder and harder as time goes on. We need to have that historic thread and weave it throughout so that they see themselves.
And I'll tell my story, because I think it's relevant. I think when we talk about nude collecting areas, there is a risk. And so the tragic story I have is with the greater exposure on the work that we were doing at Middlebury College, in particular to archive social media around protests, very recent protests that caused quite a stir with our alum. An elderly female donor, actually in response to the activities on campus and the attention that we were paying on those activities to the archives, withdrew a donation in the high five figures. Mm-hmm. So it's a significant chunk of my budget. And it was a process that lasted about 2 weeks, increasing disappointment with the way students were acting and a lack of interest in having the conversation about what it means to document student life in a complicated world in which there are many voices. And it was a case in which, in the end, I decided it was one I lost. And I needed to move forward knowing this is the work we're doing, and if it means this work isn't supported by this endowed fund, so be it. It was painful when it happened, but it was one of those cases where the risk is speaking from your heart and from a place of professional commitment, and then letting the cards fall.
When you take that risk, how is the administration supporting you?
Because to me, I would think the administrators want the money. So how do you handle that? What kind of backlash do you suffer then?
So that, I think, as Audra said, our college advancement is a very tightly organized and centralized organization. So it was, when that trouble started brewing, it was highly mediated through advancement officers. So they knew it was happening. They waited a few days to tell me. And what actually happened in the end is, because there was so much backlash around this one political, this moment in the college's recent history, they actually just wanted it to go away because it was one of the smaller donations that was at threat of being pulled by an older group of alumni that have more conservative politics than a more recent group and our current students. So as much money as it was to me, because it did come right out of my budget in the larger scheme of things, I didn't have the support because it was a small piece of the pie. So I think under different circumstances, perhaps you'd have more power depending on the influence your administrators had. But the moment in time was, Rebecca, can we let this disappear? And I agreed.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Matt Johnson. I'm actually not a librarian. I'm a book conservator at the Conservation Services in North Carolina. But I often, I was thinking and listening this morning, and I'm
State University. My question is, have any of you had experience with, or let me flip the way I'm thinking about this. So part of the problem, I think, as far as filling the gaps or getting, making it more equitable across the board with including people of color or marginalized groups, is that I think universities, whatever institutions, go after the same donors, and they're usually white and rich. And so in order to disrupt kind of that balance of power, I'd like to know what people are doing at the institution on the development level or in the organizational level to cultivate relationships with wealthy, marginalized people, because once you start including those donors, then the power shifts, because we all know we live in a capitalist society. The currency is, you know, money, who has money. And there are plenty of, I think there's a fallacy that, oh, these downtrodden people of color or whatever, they don't have any money. There are plenty of deep pockets that are black and brown, and, you know, whatever the case may be. What's happening to disrupt that balance of power so when the donor rejects, you know, wants her money back, you have someone lined up who'd be very well, you know, who, you know, say, here's even maybe more money than that.
I think we should ask Athena to answer. Because she said she had it prepared.
Oh, yeah. It was her question.
I love that question, Ms. Jackson.
I think that alumni, really, I know that some of the institutions that are at the desk, have the desk right now, how was referencing? the days are probably don't have that kind of, but you have other types of relatable things, but I was very surprised at Penn State about some of the historical student groups that we weren't collecting actively for, because they weren't born from sort of the structure of student engagement that began in the 19th century. So you have all of these like burgeoning groups that happened that they're from their own volition, their own political will, and capturing their stories is almost like the same thing where you capture the stories of populations who are reluctant to give you their stories because they don't want you to retell their story in your context. But just recently I talked to a graduating senior at Penn State who is going off to be a student teacher for America. But he's from an extremely wealthy family. And I didn't realize this till we talked. You know, his dad started hospitals in South America and da 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 da. And all of a sudden that conversation about his student group that we weren't capturing turned into a potential donor relationship with a 22-year-old, right? Because sometimes the well-heeled people of marginalized people of any fill in the blank, their students are in school right now, right? Maybe they don't understand the context because our high development targets them, but that hasn't told us, you know, because they're targeted, believe it, you know, because once they find out their income, they get put into that list of people they want to nurture. So I think talking to your central development, which I've been doing, about how we can get their investment in special collections to help tell their stories while their children are there has been something I'm trying to do right now. And that has been, so I'm always looking at we all say this, every student comes in as a potential donor, and I was like, well, you have the papers and letters of David Fultz, you know, we can't wait. but that's sort of the one thing. And I will say that one question about the media, that your records management is really powerful too, if you can work with your records management group, and we're doing that too, so a little plug there. But I agree, there's money out there, and we're just not nurturing it well enough.
Richard Saunders from Southern Utah University, and may remember my question yesterday in the plenary session. One thing that I have learned in the 30 years that I've been in the library is that the currency is not money. Money is just the end result. The real currency is relationships. And so where you, and we've all kind of talked around about it in different ways, how we build the relationships. you should mention that. Here's something, if you're in a position, here's something that, that an opportunity for you to make a difference in the world.
I thought I'd meet you halfway. Katie McCormick, I'm the Associate Dean for Special Collections at Florida State University. Thank you all for a great panel and conversation. The thing I've been thinking a lot about, and to frame it in the context of the conference, a part of storytelling that we don't talk about very much or think about very much is actually listening. That story is not a tightly framed, unflexible or inflexible thing. Storytelling is about reaction. It's about listening and observation and pivoting for audience and moment and what the element and who's there and what's what people are interested in. And I think when we talk about storytelling in special collections and archives and advocacy, and whether that's with your internal or external IT department, whether that's your development officers, whether it's the donors who come through the door, who you want to work with, and the donors who come through your door who you don't want to work with, right? And as we're in these changing environments, being able to have a sort of framed plan to know what it is that we need, what it is that we need to ask for from any of those groups, to think about it not just in the concept or in the framework of we need these resources to do this task, we need these resources to acquire this thing, but to think about the total framework of our work that is about interaction, engagement, learning, connecting communities who may not be in our reading rooms with what it is that we have and what it is that we do. When you can go out in the world and you can sit with that donor, whether that be the 80-year-old curmudgeonly conservative white man, being very generalistic here, or the 22-year-old person of color who you're working with on this collection, as Athena was just talking about, to listen first and to discover in what it is that they're saying where the connection is. So maybe it's not that they're going to provide money to acquire that thing that I'm desperate to acquire, but perhaps they're fundamentally interested in engaging a particular community. I can get money for that. And so just a thing that has felt absent from this conversation was the notion of listening and how to pivot in that message and pivot in what it is that we're asking for based on who's in front of us and how it is that our work and our missions align with what it is that their interests and desires are and how that might affect us over time, and whether that's working with communities outside of our organizations that our development officers or others are not immediately targeting, just sort of listening to who is out there. I think that's a really important part of this collective storytelling process.
Can I just say, as part of doing a SWOT, though, that is what you would capture. Oh, sorry. So our SWOT, you know, Odyssey strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats. You know, I hadn't been there that long. We did this strategic plan in June, and I got there in March. But the other staff actually, believe it or not, have a virtually new staff too, which is why we never say we always used to do it that way, because we don't know how it was done. We have actually no idea how things happen there. So we're just making up new ways, which is really liberating. But the longest person that has been there has been 30 years. She's a Marine, and she's awesome. So if you want something done, hire a Marine. She gets it done. So she's my LTA. Yeah, female Marine. She's my LTA. She's been there 30 years, and she's heard a lot of patrons. So I understand what you're saying about, like, when you're trying to collect, hearing their stories from, you know, trying to collect marginalized communities. But then there's just services, too, listening to people saying, well, you know, when you were in your old building, and they think it was so beautiful and so amazing, you used to have a parking lot. Mm-hmm. And they go on and on glorifying this parking lot because, you know, genealogists tend to be older people. And this parking lot is really a big deal for them. Accessibility, it's joke. Like, it's a big deal, and I get that. So that was something we heard a lot was, I used to come here every day. I'd spend 10 hours here because you had a parking lot. And in San Francisco, it's pretty rare to have that. Now you have nothing, and I can't come. And so that's a weakness we have. And we listened, and I've heard it, too, in the short time I've been there. And that's something I don't think we'll be able to overcome, because, I mean, no one gets parking on campus, not even the faculty. There is no parking in San Francisco. But listening to that, so even just services, knowing their challenges, I think, I mean, in a SWAT, you would do that, but maybe I didn't call it out as much. But, yeah, listening.
I just had a comment going back to the question about diversifying and cultivating relationships with donors of color. And I just started writing down some notes. That's a really important and interesting question. I was thinking about the idea of trust and finding affinities with folks who have shared goals. And I think that continuing to keep on your story, your goals, will help you find folks. I would seek out folks who are your allies in this effort. And by, you know, it could be as formal as an advisory board or as informal as your circle of friends who you can talk to openly about this, who themselves are hopefully embedded or connected with the communities that you yourself may not have experience, lived experience or otherwise in. So I just wanted to comment on that. I thought we've been successful in building relationships with the Vietnamese American community in Orange County, for example, in intentionally hiring students, archivists, librarians from these communities, but also in building relationships with leaders in the community who know the donors in that community, and not just having our development officer be the one going out there and talking to folks. That it's about trust and people feeling comfortable talking to who they're talking to.
I would just like to say that we all need to stop being dismissive about genealogists. I shared that perspective for my entire career at academic research libraries and at the University of Chicago. Took great pleasure in sending them north to the Newberry. I am now on the other side of that equation. The genealogy so-called users represent about 60% of the Newberry's users. It is now called local and family history. It is not a magnet for blue-haired ladies tracing their heritage back to the Mayflower so they can apply for DAR membership. And if you want to attract users of color or marginalized users, look for people who are interested in their local and family history. And the Newberry more than once has received a very large bequest from someone who never set foot in our special collections reading room, but haunted the general reading room where our local and family history specialists bend over backwards to help them research their own family roots. So anyway, let's stop calling it bad, or at least, anyway, being elitist to that.
So I actually agree, because the Sutro Library was the largest genealogical library west of Salt Lake City. So when Gary Strong made that decision to make us a genealogical library, he did it big, as you can imagine Gary Strong would do. So the only gifts we have received to the Sutro Library in the last 30 years have been from genealogists, fiscal gifts. We have an endowment for some of our genealogical collections, and we just received another large gift also. So the genealogists are fabulous in that regard. Problem obviously for me is they can't get there anymore. So I have now a new audience I need to cultivate. The genealogists also are moving into an online platform, and we realize that that's the future of that part of research. We too are called a family and local history repository. But what I would say is, so now that I'm there and I have this genealogical history that we are moving away from, we're still going to be it, but we're not going to focus on it as much. a talk we just did in March,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Finding your African American relatives that were in the war.
Yeah.
These are the talks that we're now sponsoring. I don't think we need to say finding your Scottish ancestors when that's probably really well documented. There's probably a book. But finding your Asian ones that came through Angel Island, that's hard. And so this is now what we are going to focus on now for our genealogy. Is all about, I want to talk about people from Thailand, the Thai community that comes in. I want to talk about the Hawaiians. We're not going to do what we have done in the past.
And I just quickly wanted to answer, I hope that it's come out that for all of us, dismantling those kind of elitist stereotypes that we might have or perceptions of those outside of our own organizations, in whatever sort of life we're on, that's where we're coming from our hearts, is not to replicate those kind of injustices. And I would say, for example, some of that relies on our own flexibility. So for example, we may have collection development policies in part to prevent things we don't want being donated to us, but that can also work against us. So for example, I learned about a writer, an alum from the college who wrote lesbian fiction, quite a successful novelist, but she wrote under a pen name. And when she offered to donate 25 of the books that she's published in the last decade, our development officer thought I wouldn't want them, of course, because it falls out of what she understood special collections to be. And I was able to say, I want them. And it's formed a great relationship. But I think in part that means we have to be honest, but perhaps let out our secrets to people we're close to on campus who can also be our advocates. But it also means being promiscuous sometimes with collections, and if we really want to draw underrepresented groups through our collections and our services, it does mean collecting differently and letting go of some of the rules that we think that our institutions have.
Yeah, and we are over,
yeah.
But if we have another, please
yeah.
go ahead.
Yeah.
We're okay sitting. We're happy to take the questions.
I had a question that somewhat followed up on these last few comments, so I'm glad to have the opportunity to ask it. We've talked a lot about deep pockets and how advocacy does not equal fundraising. However, given trying to, all your hard work to advocate within a local community, or to people who might actually be intrigued by special collections because of born digital collections, new audiences, new communities, you do all of this advocacy work. We're also in a world where people are seemingly really willing to like throw $5 at something that they don't even know through a GoFundMe or something. I wonder whether you've seen any connections between broader advocacy to communities and not just deep pockets, but maybe, normal pockets, and leveraging that into fundraising or support in other creative ways.
It's not my project, so I'm not plugging it, but Thomas Mullaney at Stanford University had done a Chinese typewriter exhibit. He has like the most Chinese typewriters than anyone else on earth. And he had this exhibit up at the Asian Art Museum at Stanford, and it was very successful. And a lot of people said, we need this to travel more. More people need to know about this early technology for Chinese characters. It's a really great project. And where is he going to get that money? So he started the GoFundMe thing, and people like me gave $5. But then other people in the community, too, that had been to his exhibit opening also gave $5. And basically with enough $5, the museum show went on the road so that more people could learn about this part of, obviously, Asian history, Chinese history. So I think there's a lot of power in that. If everyone just gave $5, and if it was more grassroots, that's because we're small and scrappy, that's actually been my approach now. Is I don't know who these big donors are yet. I just got here, but I'm seeing a lot of students that have $3, $2, $5, and that's sort of going to be my approach for now.
Yeah, we've done crowdsourcing recently for the first time for collecting, centering around beginning with the Women's Protest March, and we used social media pretty aggressively to invite people to contribute their signs and stories and so forth. And we actually got IT very interested in that. So it was the quickest turnaround they ever managed in my short history there to create an online submission process for digital images and stories. And we hooked it very legitimately into historic interest in protests in Chicago and the Midwest, and obviously there's risks in it. We also just got a 2.5 million postcard collection, and we certainly don't want to crowdsource for people's shopping bags of family postcards, so we're scrambling to do a collecting policy, but I think there are opportunities for crowdsourcing and collecting areas.
So I think it's about 11:10, so I just wanted to thank the speakers again for a wonderful panel, and thank all of you for attending and for listening.
It's an open submission.
Well, with deadlines.
Well, work with deadlines. August is the well, end of July is for the fall.
For the first,
which,
would be for fall.
But I got to get stuff to review. Yeah. January, well, we'll see. March's issue that I will be starting.
Hi, I'm Kathy Marquis. I'm a WPI.
Thank you very much for hosting us a few weeks ago for AIC. We're looking forward to it. Very excited about it. I think it'll be good. But we, I also visited Charlie Sheerer.
Well, officially not until the end of the month.
Uh-huh. Congratulations.
But I'm not going to waste my time.
No, you can't.